We are back with our After Dark episode for Patreon. I always want, they're patrons if they're on your Patreon, if they subscribe to Patreon.
Patreonians. They are Patreon patrons of the greatest podcast about the dark side of creativity, art of darkness. Yeah. I'm selling it to the people who are already subscribed.
Have already bought it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're following up now with Adam Lehrer. We just had a great conversation about William S. Burroughs, Annika Vaughn, heroin, literature, all of that. It was fantastic. And we're gonna go for a little bit longer here. We might as well jump right into it. So one thing that Adam talks about in his wonderful book, Communions, and I really mean it. Like, this is a good book. People should read it if they're all interested in you know, Annika Vaughn, William S. Burroughs, a bunch of other people. If they're interested in the intersection of drugs and art, if they're just interested in good writing. But one thing Adam talks about, he refers to Burroughs as a shadow intelligence asset, shadow intelligence agent.
And he's all and above.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk more about that. So what do you got for us in that regard?
Yeah. Well, it comes down to a few different things. When I did that big thread about intelligence agents, the one that, you know, some was actually true and based on factual information, such as, you know, the CIA and the abstract expressionists, for example. But the one I have never been able to verify, but have kind of no doubt about his working for intelligence in some capacity, was William S. Burroughs. Partly this has to do with the fact that he's like a blue blood, you know, from Kentucky, yeah. Harvard educated. His uncle was a literal press agent for Rockefeller. And but what I think would be interesting about Burroughs here is that, like, so many of the people who turned out to be CIA assets, Timothy Leary, Jerry Garcia, all those hippies, they probably would have been, like, ashamed of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Burroughs wasn't really, he certainly wasn't, like, a radical or definitely not an anarchist. He had he really kind of believed in order. And he was even conservative to an extent. And, you know, and he very much like his life as a drug addict and as a homosexual man, like he preferred it being in these sorts of like shadow worlds that he saw, he thought should be separate from like mainstream society. But he also had this really, I mean, there's a reason that, you know, Deleuze and Foucault theorized control society using Burroughs's work as their sort of primary influence on that theory, which is that, again, language is a virus. Burroughs understood perhaps better than any artist ever that power, using rhetoric as wield by like these technologically advanced centers of power, could infect, control, and manipulate human minds. And he also is, to an extent, because his work allows us to be thinking in this way, he kind of is like the archetypal counter agent of the avant-garde. But I've always been convinced to an extent that William Lee, his alter ego in the books, who is like, you know, the book Naked Lunch, sometimes it's at the end, sometimes it's at the beginning. William Lee is an agent who kills a cop and then has to go on the run. And, you know, the first chapter is like, you know, William trying to gather enough drugs to go head out. But, I just really like this idea that Burroughs, you know, when he was traveling all through these weird places, having weird, strange meetings that are sort of hinted at throughout the work but never clarified, probably was both an information source. And also, I mean, he's such a keen observer of humans and of crime. I can see him being very, very useful as, you know, as eyes and ears on the ground, so to speak, in these sorts of like transgressive outer spheres of human civilization.
Yeah. And, you know, I love this. And thinking about, I've always wondered exactly how did he get out of that situation in Mexico, right?
Right.
When he killed his wife, like what, in it's not that big of a stretch to imagine that somebody from the US government came to him and said, Bill, we're going to get you out of this, but you're going to owe your country a favor.
100%. Right? That's how they get people.
Right. They haven't been a compromising situation. You know, he's got these connections through, you know, to the, you know, the pretty high levels of American aristocracy already. Yeah. I love that.
You know, and I think, you know, he talked about the death of Joan constantly as mm-hmm. the thing that basically made him an artist.
Right.
You know, it was like the trauma. And I fully believe, like, some people don't believe that the death was accidental. I kind of do. You know, there's a description by one of his friends who was present that Bill kind of came out of his drunken stupor realizing what had happened and was just like screaming, Joan, what have I done? Right. You know, that kind of thing. Like, him and Joan weren't a typical couple, but she was his best friend, you know?
Yeah, he definitely cared about her.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, he talks about being possessed by the ugly spirit. I kind of take the notion of demons and sort of demonic possession. I take it fairly seriously. And I think if someone tells you they're possessed by I mean, what else is saying you're possessed by an ugly spirit, but saying you're possessed by a demon?
Absolutely.
I think depending on your, you know, cosmological construction, at least metaphorically, he was possessed or haunted by something, and it sort of took the wheel in that moment when he shot Joan.
Absolutely. These sorts of like moments of madness, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. Because even if you're the best marksman ever, you have to know that that's pretty stupid.
That's
right?
Pretty dumb. Yeah.
Yeah, the best marksman ever wouldn't do it.
Right.
Would never even. Yeah.
And then like, so he gets off this crime easily. Like, you know, kind of out of nowhere, you have to assume somebody was tinkering with something, saying this guy's important for this reason, important for that reason. Harvard and Yale, of course, is like the nexus of the CIA. That's where most of them go. Mm-hmm. And
even that boys' school he went to in Los Alamos, that whole place is fishy to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, you've got the upper crust of American society. They're all sending their boys out to the desert where not long later we are going to test nuclear weapons. Like, the whole thing is just... I don't know enough about it to say anything other than it makes me raise my eyebrow. Just
absolutely.
Yeah.
And the thing with Burroughs too is like, it's always been so interesting to me that his work has been such an influence on queer theory, because it's so like, he's not talking about this shit positively.
Right.
It's like he's taught, like, it's very much like, everything is like a bit disgusting in Burroughs's work, right? Well, like, it's all abject and not really celebratory.
Yeah, and he didn't, other than being, in my understanding anyway, and correct me if I'm wrong, other than having a certain sense of protectiveness over the so-called gay community, he never like identified with the gay community, I don't think.
No,
I don't think he saw himself as like part of the gay rights movement or anything along those lines.
Definitely not. And he was pretty skeptical of politics of emancipation altogether, but he was skeptical of power at the same time. But he even said once, like somebody had asked him if he considered himself a communist, and he said, quote, I don't give a shit about the masses, and I never did. So like, he's very much like kind nice. Of Oof. Is what he was, which was yeah. a Southern bourgeois aristocrat, but one like that's what makes him so cool, is he's like a blue blood gone horribly wrong.
yeah deeply but
those
American
sensibilities, yeah, but those sensibilities, it's like, you know, this kind of enthusiasm for traditionalism is even a reactionary like aesthetic that kind of courses through his work, that's not unlike you know, some of the reactionary greats like Celine or whatever.
Yeah.
But Burroughs is like, he's very interested in power and how power can manipulate, but he's never like truly, you know, I mean, Deleuze would take that sort of critique and then formulate a way of understanding and opposing it. But Burroughs is more just like conceptualizing it and like, because of him, we understand like information warfare better, I think.
Yeah.
And this is why McLuhan was, of course, really interested in Burroughs too, even though he got certain aspects of his work wrong, I think.
Yeah. So yeah, Burroughs. Well, that was the other thing, is yeah, Burroughs was interested in articulating these systems of control. He was interested in throwing them off in terms of controlling his own life, but it wasn't like he had a moral opposition to using them. Like,
no,
if he would come across a technique for getting one over on somebody, getting back at somebody, it wasn't like he was going to avoid that in some way. Feels like he just didn't want it used on him.
Yeah, absolutely. And one has to wonder, how could he have developed such insight about the ways that information is deployed upon populations without some sort of experience in seeing how it all worked? I mean,
how much of that do you think goes back to his family fortune and the adding machine and being around that milieu? Do you think he was exposed to sort of the machinations of how an organization like that operated? Where do you think he came across it? Just wealth, the knowledge of what that means? Yeah.
And like, the thing is like, his family sold the company when he was still pretty young, and way before it became like they retired millionaires. They could have been billionaires. So he is kind of like, you know, he's like petty bourgeois. He's not quite ruling class, but at the same time, he had all the educational background and proximity to real wealth, real power, and real control that would necessitate some sort of awareness in how it all functions after a while. And he also was just like, the other thing with Burroughs is just like, he traveled so much, weird places that Tangier, of course, would become sort of a bohemian playground in the 60s and 70s, but he went all over the place. There's that whole, in the Barry Miles autobiography, there's that whole plot about him traveling throughout South America
with that
straight guy that he basically psyoped into being his boyfriend for a while. You know?
Yeah. In search of ayahuasca.
Exactly. He was kind of interested in the insight that drug might give him. Mm-hmm. But there's even like Burroughs is like one of my favorite people to just watch give interviews. He's like a brilliant conversationalist, and he's like incredibly careful about what he says. But even the way he gives conversations feel like kind of manipulation tactics. Like, you never really form a rigid understanding of who mm-hmm. he is.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I've watched many, I've read the majority of his work and watched him. The one thing, I guess, this is something I kind of wanted to talk about, and I think it vaguely kind of ties in. It's like, in one sense, I understand why all of these other sort of countercultural, if we want to call them that, figures kind of glommed onto him. Kurt Cobain and Patti Smith and who, you know, Patti, I don't know why Patti Smith is in like the biography of every artist after a certain point. I don't get it. I don't understand what her deal is. Like, how she's the Forrest Gump of like American art post 1960.
Oh my God,
it's very weird.
So true, yeah.
Yeah. She's always there.
the Zelig of wild. Yeah, she's everywhere.
And you know, I'm not going to speak ill of her, but I don't get it. But
All right.
I always kind of when the appeal that, you know, that somebody like Kurt Cobain or whatever felt for him, I never quite, it's like I understood sort of what I saw in Burroughs, but I never quite understood what those people saw in him, because you put them right next to each other and they don't just visually, they don't make any sense. And
totally.
And the work he was doing, I don't see any connection between the work he was doing and the work that, say, Kurt Cobain was doing. Like, I don't see how those things line up personally, but maybe I'm missing something.
Yeah, him and Ballard especially sort of formed the backbone of what would become like postmodern literature in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And also they're huge influences on cyberpunk. So like, you know, 1978 rolls around and you have like Ian Curtis and, I mean, Ian Curtis especially, like he was obsessed with both Ballard and Burroughs. And then Burroughs ended up doing all these kinds of, he'd do live readings at places like the Mud Club in Manhattan.
Right.
And he became this sort of countercultural figure. But it's very interesting the way that that metaphor could function, because the thing with punk is that it was very nihilistic. It was like the absence. It was like, you know, Adam Curtis, who I have a lot of problems with, but he said something very insightful in, I think it was not the recent one, but the one before, Hypernormalization, which is that 1978 rolls around and artists are no longer really interested in emancipatory politics. It becomes more about like nihilism and degradation, decay. And this kind of trend would like repeat a couple times all the way until the early 2000s, really, with like Dash Snow and all those artists, which was very much about like 9/11 and partying at the end of the world. So Burroughs represents this kind of detachment and sage. He's like a sage druid figure who deeply understands the rising postmodern financialization economy. Without sort of any of the kind of utopian glee that shaped the new left. Like Burroughs was really kind of a rejection of the new left. And God, he's just such a great writer. I think a lot of people just kind of were just like blown away by his work.
Yeah, that I can understand. Yeah, just the magnetism of the work itself, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting. And then he ends up in a, this is one thing I think we talked about in the episode we did, the very bizarre moment of Burroughs being in a Nike commercial.
I know.
Are you aware of that?
I've read something about it, but I know he kind of got a little, like cringy towards the end of his life. Like he'd show up in basically anything.
Yeah. Well, part of that was probably needing money and
of course.
Yeah. Who knows what. And it's gotta be a little, you know, for as brilliant and insightful as he was, it had to have been, you know, he was born in whatever he was born, 1912 or something along those lines, 1914 maybe.
Yeah, he was already an old guy by the time that he started writing, really.
Yeah, so you hit the 90s and you're like this sort of lauded figure. It's got to be a little confusing.
Absolutely. And you know what's so interesting about him too is like he's kind of the beat poet that doesn't feel like a beat poet.
Yeah, he's like, got almost nothing in common with Ginsberg and Kerouac artistically.
No, not at all. Yeah. I mean, you could say maybe hunky a little bit, but hunky's mm-hmm. just so much like he's writing just like autofiction about being a junkie criminal. Yeah. Burroughs was a bit more philosophical than that.
Yeah.
And the people that he does seem to have more in common with were like European writers, you know, mm-hmm. Alain Robbe Grier and Ballard and mm-hmm. Pierre Guillotat,
mm-hmm.
Which is like, I think what makes him stand out to the degree that he does. He's probably the one American literary figure of the 20th century who, you know, people that are like into cool writers or whatever, like right. the real kind of avant-garde. He's kind of the one, even though I think there's more that belong on that list, but he's kind of like the American avant-garde figure of the 20th century.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say for sure. Yeah. And the work holds up. I mean, he's got the chops to back it up, right? It's not posing. It's not purely aesthetics. It's
absolutely
surreal, you know.
I mean, I got like really mad. I did this podcast once when the book first came out, and someone was one of the hosts was like, "He only published like two things." I was like, "What?" Published like 15 novels of varying quality. Like, and yeah. Like really, there's everything in his catalog is worth reading. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Even some of the lesser revered ones like The Wild Boys are still pretty great.
Well, yeah. And all of that goes without saying anything about how influential the cut-up technique was and remains.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
use that. They still use that.
I use it, you know? Like, yeah. And Geisen himself, like Geisen's kind of texts are, you know, they're not always so fun to read, but I love his paintings. Like, I think... I mean, talk about like a mystic artist. His paintings mm-hmm. really do kind of look like you're like a psyche or something, mm-hmm. like how a psyche would look if you could visualize it. Mm-hmm. And just the way that these guys were they were following a trajectory, I suppose, that traced back to Tristan Tzara and the Dadaists for sure. And then would be carried over to a degree by industrial music and male art, but you know, this was like an exciting turning point in like what we think of as the novel, mm-hmm. and I think Burroughs is this simultaneously like he's a countercultural figure who's also like counter-revolutionary to an extent. Like he's mm-hmm. telling us how power functions in the late 20th century, but not mm-hmm. necessarily opposing that power. He's kind of like, he's more intrigued by it than anything.
Yeah.
But and from that, his work becomes kind of like a Rorschach test that you can project your own sort of
yeah.
thinking
yeah.
onto.
Right. No, I think that's very true. We're going to close down here, but this makes me think of usually what we do in a normal episode is we ask at the end, what would this person be doing now? And I'm going to change that a little bit. What do you think Burroughs would make of 2022 America?
Oh man.
I mean, I want to know. I wish I knew. Like, I kind of wish he was here because his take on it is interesting, as interesting as anybody's take would be.
Absolutely. And, you know, God, I could be projecting my own sort of beliefs here, but I think COVID-19 is the proof of Burroughs' thesis that language is a kind of virus. Especially when you consider the fact, like SARS 10 years ago, SARS was about, it was almost as deadly as COVID was. And yet nobody cared.
Right.
Right. So right. What changed in between then? And it's very obvious that what changed then is that the internet is no longer something that you log on to, but is something that is blasted into your pocket, you know,
yeah, you
vibrating in for, yeah, you're living in it literally all the time. So, so even though, you know, most of us are probably in no kind of serious danger from this virus, unless, you know, you're with comorbidities or whatever, there's been this absolute just panic inflicted upon particularly urban centers, which itself are like the centers of information. So you have this whole thing that's like, yes, this virus is real, but the hysteria is utterly manufactured and enforced by power centers of information. If Burroughs was able to maintain his same disposition, and certainly a lot of artists have shocked me with their inability to think critically about what's happening in the world right now.
Yeah, for sure.
But if Burroughs was able to maintain that disposition, he would know that his thesis about the functionings of language in a control society, in an information society, is 100% true. That you can, as someone in power, change how a population thinks through the battering of information warfare. And that is both like terrifying and also really fascinating if you're someone that has my interests.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe what we need to do, and I'm surprised we haven't seen it yet, is somehow memeify William S. Burroughs. Like, I don't, it feels like there should be some William S. Burroughs counter narrative memes floating around.
Absolutely.
You know,
just maybe like the language is a virus, and then like language is a virus, and then you show people like wearing like five masks or whatever.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, Adam, I am completely on board with what you said there. The media is the disease. The social media is the virus itself.
And that's it.
Completely obvious to people who think like we do. However, most people do not.
Yeah.
And so here we are swimming through the wasteland. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was, I had a really great Lyft driver last night, and my friend and I were sort of complaining about COVID on the way home. And the guy turns around and he's like, man, you have no idea what a relief it is to be able to say out loud how much I hate this stuff. Usually I'm walking on eggshells to even address the fact that anything's weird, but it is weird that my five-year-old is being forced to take a shot they don't need just to go back to school. And I'm like, yeah, it's weird. It's
worse
it's
than
not
weird.
Right.
Yeah.
It's satanic.
It is satanic in the sense that it's an inversion, and yeah, absolutely. Well, look, this has been amazing, and your insights into Burroughs are pretty incredible, and Kavan as well. And I appreciate you sharing what you had to share about heroin and addiction and all the rest. And I really think we should, if not this year, maybe in the fall, maybe in the summer. I don't know what our schedule looks like, but if we can, we should get you on to do the Arto episode with
That'd
us.
That'd be great.
That would be awesome. I will start rereading all his stuff. Also, quick shout out really quick, because I don't think he gets enough appreciation for the work he does. Stephen Barber's biographical work on Antonin Artaud is incredible.
Okay.
Stephen Barber's, I think, top three literary critics writing, still writing. And his work was very helpful to me writing the book, and I'd like people to check his work out.
For sure. Yeah, we'll fold that into the eventual Arto episode for sure. Yeah, thank you so much, Adam. This has been great. Really appreciate your time, and it's cool to make a connection and thank you.
Yeah,
so
guys,
much.
This was great. I really appreciate the work that you're doing on this show, and it's great to be framed in this kind of way amongst such like great writers and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure. Well, you take care of yourself out there, man. We're gonna survive the control systems, I believe.
Yes, so, indeed. Get recruited into the counterinsurgency of the avant-garde. So
all right,
speak.
All right.
I'm infect the infectors.
Exactly. Infect the infection. Exactly.
All right.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.
Yep, be good.
Later. Bye.